This is the podcast ICU Rounds. My name is Dr. Jeffrey Guy. I'm an associate professor of surgery and director of the Burn Center at the Vanderbilt University School of Medicine in Nashville, Tennessee. Today we're going to talk about the medication propofol. Now, propofol is used in a variety of settings in the intensive care unit, emergency department, operating room, and even in the pre-hospital environment. I've talked about propofol in another podcast that I did. It's for free, and it's called Pharmacology for the Pre-Hospital Professional. I did that podcast shortly following the death of Michael Jackson. There was a lot of interest among medical providers and non-medical providers about some more information about propofol. But today I'm going to talk about one of the complications of propofol that is potentially fatal, and often very few providers are aware of it. And those providers that do know something about it often don't know what causes it, and sometimes know very little bit about how to treat it. And what we're talking about today is what's called propofol infusion syndrome. Now, propofol has gained widespread popularity, as we mentioned, in both the induction and maintenance of general anesthesia, as well as in intensive care unit, because it's a drug that has a very rapid onset. It's got a quick recovery and really little effects, and has a very favorable neurological profile, particularly when used in the intensive care unit for the treatment of critically ill patients, because it will decrease the cerebral metabolic rate and decrease oxygen consumption. Propofol can also decrease intracranial pressure. And also, it has anticonvulsant effects. So you can see that propofol is a reasonably attractive drug. Now, one thing that's important to remember about propofol is propofol is a drug that has no analgesic properties. Because many of these properties, propofol is routinely used for sedation of patients in intensive care units, and it's used at an increase in frequency for the sedation of invasive procedures. From endoscopy to invasive procedures such as things as chest tubes and minor surgical procedures. Now, be mindful, as I already mentioned, propofol is not an analgesic. I frequently see people being transferred with propofol by air medical services, patients who have large burns, and some of those transportation durations can be typically measured in hours, particularly when patients are transported great distances by fixed wing, which is a fancy name for saying airplane. Now, there are some significant cardiovascular and respiratory depressant effects of propofol, and they're well known to most of the practitioners, but there's also what's called this propofol infusion syndrome. Propofol infusion syndrome was initially described by an author named Bray in 1998. They discussed their case series in the journal Pediatric Anesthesia. It was 1998, volume 8, pages 491 to 499. They coined this phrase, propofol infusion syndrome, to describe a clinical state associated with propofol infusion in children. Now, they had 18 cases at that time. Most of the patients in their case series had respiratory infections. There was a high mortality rate of 83% of the children who had this propofol infusion syndrome. They define propofol infusion syndrome as an acute refractory bradycardia that led to asystole. And this asystole occurred in the presence of one or more of the following: a metabolic acidosis with a base deficit of greater than 10, rhabdomyolysis or myoglobinuria, lipemic plasma, or a clinically enlarged liver, or a fatty liver on autopsy. The first case series of a propofol-related infusion syndrome death was reported in 1990. This was a 2-year-old girl who had croup. She had been on propofol for 4 days and on an average infusion rate of 165 micrograms per kilogram per minute. This child developed metabolic acidosis, heart failure, hypotension, as well as hepatomegaly. It was noted early on that a lot of these cases of propofol-related infusion syndrome in children occurred in children who had upper respiratory tract infections, and there was really no safety data on ICU propofol use. And so AstraZeneca, the manufacturer of propofol, added the following statement: Diprivan is contraindicated for the sedation of children of all ages with croup or epiglottitis receiving intensive care. And this was added to their prescribing information. They felt at that point that there seemed to be a causal relationship between upper respiratory tract infections and the development of this propofol-related infusion syndrome. Now, in 1996, there were an increasing report of propofol-related infusion syndrome also occurring in adults. The first cases perhaps were an adult that was a 30-year-old woman. She had an upper respiratory failure from asthma. She developed a severe anion gap metabolic acidosis after only being on propofol for 2 hours. And despite the absence of other causes of shock, such as hypoxia, hypotension, sepsis, shock, diabetes, or catecholamine administration, lactic acidosis on this patient resolved within 12 hours after the propofol infusion ceased and the patient was uneventfully extubated. But here is, this patient was not on a protracted use of propofol that you may see perhaps for days in the intensive care unit. This patient was on it for only 2 hours. It's important to keep in mind that, as I mentioned, that some patients are transported great distances, either by ground ambulance or air platforms, a rotor wing helicopter or an airplane, and a lot of times they may be on propofol for the duration of that flight. And often that transportation time may exceed 2 hours, which is certainly enough time for an adult and certainly a child to develop a propofol-related infusion syndrome. The first propofol-related infusion syndrome death in an adult was reported in the year 2000. It was an 18-year-old male who was on 100 to 125 mics per kilogram per minute of propofol in the ICU after the patient was involved in a motor vehicle crash. The patient developed elevated creatine kinase levels on day 3. By day 5, the patient developed progressively worsening arrhythmias, culminating in pulseless electrical activity and death. His laboratory report showed metabolic acidosis, lipemia, as well as hyperkalemia. Kramer and colleagues reported in Lancet in the year 2001. This is Kramer et al., Lancet 2001, volume 357, pages 117 to pages 118. Now, they did a retrospective study of adult neurosurgical ICU patients, and they found that 7 of 67 patients with head injury who received propofol from sedation showed some signs of a propofol-related infusion syndrome and died. Of importance, they found a dose-dependent relationship. No patients showed a sign of propofol-related infusion syndrome if they had been at a dose of 5 mics per kilogram per hour. At a rate of 5 to 6 milligrams per kilogram per hour, there was a 17% incidence, and at greater than 6 milligrams per kilogram an hour, there was a 31% incidence of a propofol-related infusion syndrome. Now, they also proposed some criteria to define this adult propofol-related infusion syndrome. And these included an age between 18 and 55 years, progressive myocardial failure with dysrhythmias, and two of the following: metabolic acidosis, hyperkalemia, evidence of muscle cell destruction. Now, per the criteria outlined by Kramer for propofol-related infusion syndrome, there must be an absence of known causes of myocardial failure and no evidence of sepsis, no evidence of multi-organ failure, or known causes of hyperkalemia, metabolic acidosis, or rhabdomyolysis. Now, the presence of a propofol-related infusion syndrome vary considerably. Now, early signs can include what we've already explained over and over again. This is unexplained lactic acidosis. They can have lipemic serum as well as cardiac dysfunction, or a EKG that has Bregutta-like EKG changes. I know what you're thinking. Bregutta-like EKG changes, what is that? Well, Bregutta syndrome is a hereditary disorder, genetic disease, characterized by an abnormal EKG findings, and patients have an increased risk of cardiac death. What does the EKG look like? For that, I would refer you to an article or a textbook. There are 3 subvariants of the Bregutta type syndrome with different EKG findings, and to describe that without the use of illustrations or photographs would make it, would be at the very least a very daunting task. If you think your patient has a propofol-related infusion syndrome and you don't feel qualified or comfortable making the diagnosis of these EKG changes, I would simply get an EKG and consult with cardiology and specifically ask point blank, are these changes present or not? There's been a lot of questioning as to whether there can be a subclinical propofol-related infusion syndrome, or does simply the infusion of propofol induce a subclinical lactic acidosis that we never try to identify. And there have been studies that have tried to delineate that propofol-related infusion syndrome is an idiosyncratic reaction that may occur in an all-or-none type of fashion. Now, changes in the cardiac function, as well as the aforementioned EKG changes, can develop in the absence of profound metabolic acidosis, and these can actually be the first sign of an impending cardiac electrical instability. Propofol may cause the effects, what is believed by perhaps a negative sodium channel blockade, or by unmasking hidden genetic channel defects. Later signs of propofol-related infusion syndrome will proceed to include cardiac failure, tachyarrhythmias, heart block, rhabdomyolysis, manifesting, as we said already, elevated CPKs or myoglobinuria. For those of you who don't know what myoglobinuria is, myoglobin is a key molecule in the oxygen transportation of oxygen through muscle cells. And when muscle cells are damaged, they release this pigment myoglobin, which is similar in many of its structural elements to hemoglobin. How do we know myoglobin is present? Is that when we look at the urine is dark and tea-colored. It looks similar to like diluted Coca-Cola. The danger in this is several, is that it means we have muscle destruction going on. And also when we have muscle destruction, we have elevated levels of potassium, because potassium lives in the cells. But this myoglobin is potentially toxic to the kidneys and can lead to renal failure. Now, certainly there's a blood test you can perform and send it to the lab and measure the myoglobin. But the other thing is that if you see this pigmented urine, it's a pretty sure bet that you have myoglobin. Another quick rapid test is you send the urine for just a straight-up urinalysis. That can be turned around almost by any lab very quickly. And if you see large free hemoglobin and very few red cells on the microscopic, then that's an indication that you more likely are dealing with myoglobinuria. We've already identified some patients who seem to be at higher risk for the development of a propofol-related infusion syndrome, and these are certainly patients you should be much more concerned about. One, about infusing propofol, and two, that if you are using propofol, that you are very aware that this patient populations are at risk. And these include patients who've had a severe head injury, patients with airway infections, young age, large total cumulative dose of propofol, a high catecholamine level, which is virtually anybody who's critically ill, burned, or with a traumatic injury, patients who have elevated serum glucocorticoid levels, patients with low carbohydrate intake and high fat intake, and simply critical illness is listed as a risk factor for the development of propofol-related infusion syndrome, as well as patients who may have inborn errors, metabolism of fatty acids. Now, we went back and said that high levels of catecholamines may be a risk factor development of propofol-related infusion syndrome. This is felt because high levels of endogenous and exogenous catecholamines are thought to contribute to propofol-related infusion syndrome by increasing propofol requirements and by causing muscle damage. Now, the key words were there, endogenous. Endogenous catecholamines released by my adrenals, caused by what? Massive trauma, postoperative surgical state, critical illness. But the other word that's used in there is exogenous. Patients perhaps on vasopressors, if somebody's on levofed or epinephrine or dopamine, if people are still using dopamine, that is potentially a risk factor for propofol. So if you have your patient who's critically injured on vasopressors, you're trying to keep them sedated in the ICU, and you're using propofol, that may be at risk for propofol-related infusion syndrome. Well, what was one of the other risk factors? Head injury. Now, if you think about your patients who have traumatic brain injuries, one of the drugs that our neurosurgeons like a lot is what? Propofol. Why? Because propofol is a turn-off, turn-on drug. They can sit there. You can keep a patient sedated. You can turn off the propofol, come by, get an assessment, and put the patient back down. But that patient with traumatic brain injury has often several of those risk factors, which make that patient more predisposed for the development of propofol-related infusion syndrome. And perhaps we need to be looking at a different drug rather than using propofol for the sedation of these critically injured and ill patients. Now, don't misunderstand what I'm saying and don't overread it or overhear it. I'm not saying propofol is a bad drug. As like all drugs, drugs have potential harmful effects. Perhaps the drug that has the most harmful effects is aspirin, which is the drug that is perhaps the most commonly used drug. But you need to understand, one, that this propofol-related infusion syndrome exists. It can occur rather rapidly. You don't have to be on propofol for days and days and days. But clearly, the longer you're on it, the more it seems that you're predisposed to it. And there are certain subsets of patients who are more prone to develop this potentially life-threatening complication related to the use of propofol. Now, as we said, the incidence of propofol-related infusion syndrome is not well known. There are about more than 80 incidents of patients with propofol-related infusion syndrome that have been reported as case reports, with deaths in over 50% of them. Now, in 2008, a retrospective MedWatch analysis of 1,139 potential cases of propofol-related infusion syndrome were identified. Now, this was found in Fong, F-O-N-G, and colleagues. The title of the article is Predictors of Mortality in Patients with Suspected Propofol-Related Infusion Syndrome. It's found in Critical Care Medicine, 2008, Volume 36, pages 2281 to 2287. Now, the study was conducted by pharmacists and looked for the predictors of mortality of propofol-related infusion syndrome. The predictors were found to be young age, that is, an age less than 18, male gender, use of vasopressors, cardiac findings, metabolic acidosis, hypotension, rhabdomyolysis, and dyslipidemia. So again, looking at this particular study, risk factors at young males, vasopressors. Again, this includes many patients who have traumatic brain injuries or multiple traumas or burns. The first large prospective study looking at the incidence of propofol-related infusion syndrome was published in 2009. This was a paper by Roberts and colleagues. It was entitled Incidence of Propofol-Related Infusion Syndrome in Critically Ill Adults, a Prospective Multicenter Trial, published in Critical Care Medicine in the years 2009. Now, this study involved critically ill patients from 11 medical centers, and they were given propofol for more than 24 hours. They were monitored at baseline and then daily for the development of a propofol-related infusion syndrome. Now, again, they've used several of these definitions we've already talked about as to what is propofol-related infusion syndrome. They described it here as a metabolic acidosis, cardiac dysfunction, along with one of the following: rhabdomyolysis, hypertriglyceridemia, or renal failure occurring after the start of propofol. Now, 11 of 1,017 patients, or 1.1%, developed propofol-related infusion syndrome. All of the propofol-related infusion syndrome patients met criteria based on metabolic acidosis, cardiac dysfunction, and renal failure. Most developed two of the three by the first day after propofol was started. 91% of these patients were receiving a vasopressor, but of interest, only 18% received greater than 5 milligrams per kilogram per hour of propofol. So again, earlier on in this podcast, we talked about that if you use less than 5 milligrams per kilogram per hour of propofol, you were probably okay. Well, this paper showed that it doesn't really provide you any real protection by using the lower dose of propofol. Now, the mortality rate in this series was lower than previous reports. We said some reports have had as high as 50% for propofol-related infusion syndrome, but in this study, the mortality rate was 18%, which is still pretty high. I mean, if you think that you're playing Russian roulette, your odds are 16% of having a bullet in the chamber. So again, 18% is a substantial mortality rate. Now, the pathophysiology of propofol-related infusion syndrome seems to be complex. It involves multiple simultaneous mechanisms. But a common feature that we keep hearing over and over and over again is this cardiovascular collapse. Now, several mechanisms have been put forward as to what causes this cardiovascular collapse. Now, propofol has a direct effect causing bradycardia, and it does this by inhibiting the sympathetic nervous system more than the parasympathetic nervous system. You keep in mind that sympathetic nervous system speeds up, parasympathetic slows it down. If you're just decreasing the sympathetic nervous system, you're going to have increased parasympathetic tone, and that's going to result in some bradycardia. Also decreases cardiac contractility, or the strength of the muscle contraction, and it does this by antagonism of beta receptors and calcium channels. So basically, if you were to think about from the use of other cardiovascular agents that we use commonly in the intensive care unit, propofol acts basically as a beta blocker and a calcium channel blocker in one drug. There's also peripheral and cardiac muscle necrosis due to an imbalance between cellular energy production as well as utilization. Now, excess serum fatty acids are also arrhythmogenic, thus predisposing these patients to cardiovascular instability as well as development of arrhythmias. We've already mentioned that elevated levels of catecholamines, both endogenous and exogenous, seem to predispose to propofol-related infusion syndrome, and they also seem to contribute to some of the stress-induced cardiomyopathy. Again, the catecholamine infusions, as well as high catecholamine states occurring from things such as burns, trauma, and sepsis. Now, it may be possible to prevent propofol-related infusion syndrome in the ICU by maintaining adequate carbohydrate supplies, limiting excess lipid load, or using alternative methods of sedation. And again, that, you know, just because you have a patient on propofol and they have a lactic acidosis, there are things that occur with a greater frequency that cause an acidosis other than propofol-related infusion syndrome. And you have to shake down those differential diagnoses. And that could be from anything that causes a decreased oxygen delivery, such as hypovolemia, cardiogenic shock, septic shock, severe anemia, severe hypoxia, carbon monoxide poisoning, or ischemic tissue. From either bowel or extremity necrosis. Now, lactic acidosis can also be caused by increased oxygen demands that occur, such as during things like exercises or seizures or shivering or malignant hyperthermia. Now, finally, conditions that interfere with oxygen utilization can cause lactic acidosis. These conditions include things like systemic inflammatory response syndrome, also known as SIRS, diabetes, malignancy, TPN, if you've got thiamine deficiency, congenital lactic acidosis, mitochondrial myopathy, certain drugs or toxins, including drugs like metformin, and nitroprusside, alcohol, propylene glycol, salicylates. These are also known as type 2 lactic acidosis. The signs and symptoms of lactic acidosis can be significantly variable and nonspecific and include things such as tachycardia, hypotension, tachypnea, altered mental status. Typically, the treatment for propofol-related infusion syndrome is really supportive. You're really kind of batten down in hatches, waiting for the storm to kind of clear. But what you're doing is supportive type of care. Clearly, the propofol has to be stopped, and you need to provide cardiorespiratory support as required. There has been some cases where hemodialysis and hemofiltration has been shown to be beneficial. Unfortunately, propofol-related infusion syndrome is often refractory to the use of things such as IV fluids and inotropes. And there has been some limited success with the use of cardiac pacing and a few successful reports, case-by-case reports, of the use of ECMO. So other things that are going on in the podcast, we have IC rounds. There's also two other podcasts that I produce that are also free to download from iTunes. One is Pharmacology for the Pre-Hospital Professional. That's a companion podcast from my book of the same title, focused mostly on pharmacology for the use of paramedics and people who are providing pre-hospital care. However, if you are a nurse or physician, I do think that a lot of the topics are very germane to daily practices in the intensive care unit or the emergency department. And finally, if you're into trauma, there's the PHTLS, or Pre-Hospital Trauma Life Support, which is a companion podcast to one of my other projects. I'm a medical director for PHTLS, which is a worldwide program providing pre-hospital trauma training for physicians, nurses, medics, and military personnel around the world. And we go through various topics there in pre-hospital trauma care. The podcast is clearly available for free from iTunes. Wizard Media has produced some applications for download, which allows you to download all the podcasts on demand. Carry them in your pocket, and that is available through the iTunes store. I believe the fee for that is $1.99, and that's, again, through Wizard Media. You've been listening to the podcast, Surgery IC Rounds. My name is Jeff Guy. Thanks for downloading. Have a great day.